So, where are we going? Where does all of this, our life, end up? What happens at the end? This is a live question for a lot of us right now, thanks to Chloe. On Tuesday night, she hosted our first Death Cafe, which is actually international thing that was started 5 years ago in England, where people simply get together of an evening or an afternoon or whatever to talk about death. And this was open to the public. It went on the Death Cafe website, but as it turns out, everybody who showed up was just from St. Paul's. There were 13 of us. And the conversation was incredibly rich and wonderful. I was talking to one person who had come to it later. He said, gosh, I feel like we were only just starting. This conversation about death is a rich one. One thing to say about death is whether we're young or old or a girl or a boy or rich or poor, we're all going to face this one. We're all headed in the same place physically. But then what? What happens after death? I have been talking a lot recently about our imaginations, and specifically our imaginations as one of the five faculties of our souls. I've been repeatedly explaining that for at least 1,000 years in the Western Christian tradition, there was an understanding that our souls had five faculties. There were the three higher faculties of our mind, reason, and will, and then our two lower faculties of sensuality and imagination. And I've been asking us to attend to what happens in that faculty of our souls, what happens in our imagination. The imagination can be the devil's playground, and it can also be a place of great richness, drawing us more deeply into Christ. I particularly was pointing this out during Holy Week when we, with our imaginations, walk alongside Jesus along those mighty acts by which we were saved. More recently, I've been putting a lot of attention and effort into helping us to understand the book of Revelation, which is a very rich book. So this is the third of three sermons I'm preaching on Revelation. The first two, on chapter 1 and then chapter 4, I think it was, helped us understand that, which is a really important thing for us here at St. Paul's, our rose window. In those first two readings, we got to see Alpha and Omega, which are two of the symbols on the outside of the rosette window. Then last week we talked about that the Lamb as Jesus, and there is the scroll, although here it's a book, with the seven seals. Those are those upside down lollipops. And there are also the bowls with the smoke and the music that's coming from the lyres. And there was even a hint of, you can see there's the chalice and the host at the bottom there. It talked about the blood of the Lamb by which we were purified. So everything was there. You can keep looking if you want, but I'm done referring to the stained glass window there. Don't want you to hurt your necks. But all of this is headed in the book of Revelation towards the stunning conclusion, which we just heard Brigitte read so beautifully. And that's the part that I want to focus on. The end of the book of Revelation, which, by the way, is also the end of the entire book of the Bible, and points to the end where we are all headed, towards death and even beyond death. Among the things that we discussed at the Death Cafe was experiences that some Christians have had of near death or approaching death. And there were a couple of very eerie but beautiful experiences that were talked about where people approached death, and not only was it the sort of classic vision of light, but in a couple of instances, there was the experience of specific people who had already died about to welcome or saying kind of not yet. What do you think of those? Is that real? Is that the brain sort of firing in a weird way just because you're close to death? Or does that actually reflect what's on the other side? What is on the other side? And of course, there's that question, what do you call that thing on the other side? Is it heaven, the kingdom of God, heavenly banquet, Zion? All of these are words for what happens on the other side of death. Today's reading, which is at the very end of the Bible, as I said, gives us yet another image. 21, verse 2, John says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband." Prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. All right, that gives us some clue as to the emotion behind seeing New Jerusalem for the first time. And what I want you to do, and you can do this, I promise, it's a faithful thing to do, is to expand this image of a bride adorned for her husband and go with whatever gender really works for you. And imagine that. If you have been married, remember that moment when you first saw your spouse adorned for the wedding. I remember the first time that I got to see Chloe in her wedding dress. It actually wasn't in the church. We had a little moment ahead of time off on the edge of a cliff, actually, overlooking the coast along Santa Barbara. And, she looked so beautiful. But I can also remember just last week when I was privileged and honored to officiate at the wedding of Antonio in Virginia. And Antonio came in first, and he was right there next to me, and he was all dressed up as a Mexican cowboy, as fancy as possible. And it was so beautiful to be standing right there and to see Virginia sort of turn the corner there and see him standing up here in his Mexican thing and just that expression on her face of seeing him up here ready to receive and welcome her. Or if you were here the week before at the wedding of Don and John, the expression on their faces as they were standing up here and exchanging vows, both of them barely able to get the words out, for the joy and the power of it all. Or I can remember 5 or 6 years ago, or maybe more, when I did the wedding, the official state wedding for Cindy and Sandra, and the image of the two of them, both beautifully dressed, coming down with their boys, Aiden and Liam, on either side of them, and that sense of just dignity and this is who we all... In any case, in each one of those cases, that's the image that John, the author of Revelation, wants us to plug into. That's the feeling, that feeling of yearning and celebration and joy. And notice, it's entering into a covenant, too, that it's that until death do us part, but in this case, it's even beyond death we won't part in this image of New Jerusalem. This city of New Jerusalem is to be loved with all that we are and all that we have. We are to honor it. It's a mysterious city. It's dazzling. It has wonderful, beautiful walls around it. It is to be perceived, for us, like a present that's beautifully wrapped. And in this life, we can't fully open that present yet, but we know that it's there and it's for us. Now, one of the things, I've mentioned this before, and I'm going to do the same geeky thing I did a couple months ago when I mentioned New Jerusalem, which is I'm going to quote a poem. When I first mentioned it, I quoted a portion of Edmund Spenser's The Faerie Queen, where the Red Cross Knight who has really screwed up and needs to be strengthened before he goes off and actually fights the dragon. So he's taken to the House of Holiness, where the sisters, who are basically faith, hope, and love, strengthen him. And then he's taken off to a hermit up on a hill who gives him a beautiful vision of the new Jerusalem up in the sky. And he wants to go there, but the hermit says, no, not yet. You have to go back and you have to go fight the dragon. Jerusalem also appears in William Blake's great poem that's been set to music. Jerusalem, do you know that tune? And did those hills in Jerusalem, right? So it's the same thing. But it's like creating Jerusalem, or the vision of creating Jerusalem here on earth. In the case of William Blake, it's in England's green and pleasant land, I think it is the line, something like that. It's not the dark satanic mills, it's the green and pleasant land. All right, so I'm going to go back even further here. Notice that's 1800. Edmund Spenser's 1600. I'm going to go back, again, still in our mother tongue, to 1400, to one of the five great writers when English writing first becomes great. So there's Chaucer, there's Julian of Norwich, there's the anonymous author of The Cloud of Unknowing, there's Walter Hilton with The Scale of Perfection. And then Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, have any of you read that? Well, the same writer who wrote that also wrote this beautiful poem, I even prefer it, called Pearl. You ever read Pearl? Are you aware of Pearl? It's a vision that the author has, and I think it's a real one. He had a two-year-old daughter that died, and he's in his grief. He's lost his two-year-old daughter, who was just perfect, like a pearl. And he has this vision where he goes up to this place where all of a sudden he sees his two-year-old daughter across a stream, and he can't cross that stream yet, and so they walk alongside this stream where she consoles her dad that she's in a better place. It's beautiful. And the climax of this is that she tells him that she's going to give him a little bit of a glimpse of where she is now. So, okay, here it is. That holy, blissful girl, that spice heaven sent, declared, in Judea's fair demesne the city lies, where the lamb once went to suffer for man's death anguish keen. The old Jerusalem by that is meant. Get that? The old Jerusalem. For there the old guilt was canceled clean, but the new in vision prescient, John saw, sent down from God pristine. You got it? In Jerusalem. The spotless lamb of gracious mien has carried us all to that fair sight. And as in his flock no fleck is seen, his hallowed halls are wholly bright. Two holy cities I figure forth. One name suits well with both of these, which in the language of your birth is City of God, or sign of peace. That's literally what Jerusalem means. In the one, the earthly Jerusalem, the Lamb brought peace on earth, who suffered for our iniquities. In the other, the new Jerusalem, is peace with heavenly mirth, and ever to last, and never to cease, and to that city in glad release from fleshly decay our souls take flight. Their glory and bliss shall ever increase in the household that is wholly bright. And then he replies to his daughter, holy maid compassionate, said I to that fresh flower and gay, let me approach those ramparts great and see the chamber where you stay. The Lord forbids, she answered straight, that a stranger in his streets should stray. But through the Lamb enthroned in state, I have won you a sight of it this day. Behold it from far off you may, but no man's foot may there alight. You have no power to walk that way, save as a spirit wholly bright. And she continues, this holy city that I may show, walk upward toward the river's head. And here against you I shall go until to a hill your path has led. Then to stir I was not slow, but under leafy boughs I sped until from a hill I looked below and saw the city as she had said. Beyond the stream in splendor spread, that brighter than shafts of sunlight shone in apocalypse, it may all be read, as he set it forth, the Apostle John. There. A vision of New Jerusalem. I will tell you that I am having a lot of fun. I'm finding it delightful to fill my imagination with what New Jerusalem might be like. I invite you to go and read the rest of Revelation. It's only a chapter and a half for you at this point, and you'll get a really wild vision of what Jerusalem, the New Jerusalem, is like. What I want to suggest to you is that the fun and the play doesn't stop there. Edmund Spenser, the anonymous author of Pearl and Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, William Blake, you invited to fill your imagination, to play with images of what this might be like. So, I now yearn for New Jerusalem. I want to fill my imagination with thoughts of New Jerusalem. I want to have a life where I am yearning for New Jerusalem and find out the way there. It's become my quest. Will you join me? Amen.